Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, November 4th.
Magnus was a bit taken back.
Arrived into the studio.
Sorry.
Yeah, using my bit early.
You got to start over. So, yes, this is Speak Up, and my name is Magnus Thielen. Joining me at the last second here in the studio.
It's me, Peter R.H.
And Fun Drive has finished up, and we want to take a moment to thank everyone who made a donation to the program. And you're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus Thielen.
Peter R.H. is here.
Yep. And this is Speak Up. Thanks for making a donation, if you did, to our fund drive this year. We spent all last week looking to our listeners and supporters to support the station. And so many of you stepped up and did. And thank you for that. We have a good show for you. We are going to start off with a segment from Danny, our journalism reporter here at the station, and we'll get to that in a minute. What are you going to be talking about this week, Peter?
Well, there's a South African Film Festival that goes from November 7th to November 17th, and I'm going to ask Magnus on his internet to go information about the festival, because I got... On my tablet, I got a bit of information about things pertaining to the history of South Africa and so on. So, Magnus, can you do that for my segment? The incidental things, how to get the tickets, how to... Anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm asking that.
In a few moments, we're going to bring you a segment from Danny on a lecture called Belongings Matter. We also have... our final segment for this year, well, not quite final, but we're of Gardening with Embark. We're going to take a break for a little bit because, of course, the growing season is over and there's just not that as much to talk about. Mm. We'll have some Bird Note and Peter's segment and some other stuff. So let's get the show going. we're going to start off with a segment from Danny on a lecture that he recently attended entitled Belongings Matter. This lecture was hosted by Nick Blomley, a professor of geography at SFU, who presented some of his research. Some of his research findings in ways in which certain laws contribute to the marginalization of unhoused and precariously housed people, as well as their personal positions. And this is quite a problem for many of the unhoused. Street sweeps are one of the ways that manifests itself. Let's take in this lecture from Nick Blomley.
This is Danny, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. And recently, on October 30th, 2024, Nick Blomley, a professor of geography at Simon Fraser University, hosted a lecture as part of the 2024 Warren Gill Lecture Series on his findings from Belongings Matter, a Canada-wide research project that seeks to document and explain the systematic confiscation and devaluation of houseless people's belongings. Nick was joined in conversation with research partner and associate professor at the Allard School of Law at the University of British Columbia, Alexandra Flynn, as well as Connie Long, an Indigenous advocate for vulnerable communities with lived experience who organizes in Chilliwack and Abbotsford. During the lecture, Blomley spoke of the precariousness of unhoused populations, belongings, and possessions. as well as the lack of options that are afforded for these populations when it comes to safe areas for these belongings. Another major part of the lecture spoke of the fact that when unhoused, you often are required to be mobile, which is something that can be made more difficult when you are constantly having to be around your belongings to make sure that they're secure. This is something that is touched upon within the lecture, as well as the overall research from Belongings Matter.
Now, belongings matter to everyone. Most of us, of course, can protect our belongings. Most of us have that expectation that our belongings will be with us in the future. If someone took those belongings away from us, I'm sure we would feel affronted, upset, disappointed, and concerned. But we would also, I hope, have remedies or solutions, ways that we could deal with that loss. We could buy a new phone, perhaps, or we could call the authorities and have that possession returned to us. Belongings matter. Belongings matter, of course, for poor people, for marginalized people, for houseless people. This is a quote from an interview I did in Surrey with a woman we'll call Bella. And what Bella made clear to me was that when you're houseless, when you're living precariously, actually all you have are your possessions. Because, of course, you don't have an apartment that you can call your own. So your belongings, in that sense, are, while they're important for everyone, perhaps they're even more important for marginalized people.
Later on in the lecture, Nick Blomley goes over the ways in which unhoused populations are often required to move their belongings in order to keep them safe. In this instance, he uses specific examples from unhoused people living in Abbotsford.
But what people also told us was that they were constantly being moved because their belongings were objectionable. It wasn't so much that the person was objectionable, not illegal to sit in a park, but their stuff was objectionable. So if you're living outside, the question of where you put your stuff becomes a very profound problem. Adding stuff, belongings to the equation, changes the equation in important ways. And these are a couple of quotes from Abbotsford in which people talked about the kind of bizarre, almost Kafkaesque experience of putting your stuff somewhere and then somebody in officialdom coming along and telling them to move their belongings just a couple of feet. And then moving it again a couple of feet. And if you don't, of course, you lose your stuff. You pack up your gear and move over here and undo, and somebody else comes along and says, you can't be here. You've got to go somewhere else. Where are we supposed to go? I don't know, but anywhere but here. What do you mean? Anywhere but here. There is nowhere that you can be, in other words, that your stuff is not at risk.
After the lecture, Nick Blomley was able to sit down with Alexandra Flynn and Connie Long. During this discussion, Connie Long was able to give some of her perspective on this issue.
The hum is, I guess, just what it sounds like. It's just this constant, almost noise for people who are living precariously or dealing with a lot of marginalized things, right? It's constant. It's just consistent. It's, say, so the person who lives in a tent down on Gladys in Abbotsford, a tent city, and they become sick. They can't even go to the hospital because of all their stuff, you know, that shopping cart that they push around that a lot of people look and go, oh, gosh, why does he have so much stuff? You know, like just... Like, tone it down a bit, you know? But these things are really important to this person. And now this person's really sick, and he can't... Once he goes to the hospital, his stuff is fair game. Your stuff is taken from your peer, from you by your peers, by your municipality, by people or by organizations that you think you can trust, like the police, people who offer social services.
Later on in the discussion, Connie Long provides some insight on her own lived experiences as someone who was previously unhoused. This is some of what she had to say.
So very, very hard. As a result of that, though, I was put in situations where I was able to identify with people that I used to look at, like, what do you have all that stuff? Why are you pushing around that cart? And now I know why. And I think it's important to share that with the rest of the world so that people understand. And I mean, if you're not part of the solution, then you're definitely part of the problem if you're sticking your face in it. Mm-hmm. I've walked down the road and have somebody throw a shoe at me, you know, and that was rough because it was like a car full of young kids, like around my kid's age. And the shame that you wear after you've lost your stuff. Because in society, we are, you know, we look at each other, they have all of this. They have all of that. Yes. And that's what makes them amazing and important. But what makes that person more important than the guy who just lost his job, you know, and was living paycheck to paycheck and is now staying at the shelter?
At the end of the discussion, Nick Blomley, Connie Long, and Alexander Flynn go over some of the proposed solutions for supporting unhoused populations, as well as some of the work that is already being done in this regard. Please take a listen.
13 years ago, when we took the city of Abbotsford to the Supreme Court for the right to be, and also for throwing chicken manure all over our camp, there was actually an older woman in the community who wanted to donate to us a small piece of land where we could, like, we had big plans for our own little community, where we had like security and mm-hmm. Offering people services, and we still have that dream. I think that it really could work. There's so many people in my peers, there are people who are, you know, homeless and lots of people living in camps, but they also are plumbers and carpenters and parents and grandparents and just people from life, people from society, right? And there's no reason why we couldn't have our own little community or big community, depending on your issue and your municipality. But like everything from plumbing to outreach work, and it all comes from everybody living there. Mm-hmm. It can work. It really can. Like, I mean, we ran a shelter, DWS, last year for the extreme weather, and it was down in the industrial area, but there are small business owners there. Some of them didn't even know we were there. Others were so supportive at the end of our run there, or of our year there, that like it's just such a good feeling to have people say, you know, that they wanted us to stay, but the landlord sold the building, so we housed between 20 and 30 people every single night, fed them the best we could, redirected people to services if they wanted them, and encouraged them to come back the next night, in which cases they mostly did.
This is what Alexander Flynn had to say about proposed solutions for supporting unhoused populations.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the backdrop to a lot of this is that we have a terrible housing crisis. We have homes that are, you know, bought and sold as sources of investment for a lot of people. And we don't have enough of the kind of housing that we need to house everybody who needs it. And that is a set of political decisions that have been decades in the making. So that's, I think, to a large extent, the backdrop of what has led us into the situation where people don't have what they need to survive. You know, that ultimately needs change from a political perspective, but I think also the law has at least a little piece to play in this. Nick and I have a lot of arguments over the role of law as being a good thing, given its historical role in injustice and its role in this way of being a source of power for particular people. But some of the best decisions in this space have come from the courts, who have put a limit on what municipalities can do or what officials can do. And I think we need as much of that as we can. There's not a lot of lawyers who are able to practice in this area, but the ones who do it literally from the sides of their desk, often without getting paid. And I think, you know, what you can only imagine if there was more capacity to really challenge some of this stuff.
Once again, this was a piece on the lecture hosted by Nick Blomley in collaboration with Connie Long and Alexander Flynn. If you want to learn more about the research that was explained throughout the lecture, you can go on belongingsmatter.ca. That is belongingsmatter.ca. Once again, this piece would not be possible without the support from the Local Journalism Initiative. Thank you for tuning in.
Thanks to our reporter, Danny, for that report. Coming up next, we have a report, another report sponsored by the Local Journalism Initiative. This is from our sister station or sibling station in Smithers, a report by Pamela Hansen about a new photography exhibition by outdoors and environmental photographer Graham Pohl. He has a new exhibition there, opening called Between Worlds, that explores what it means to be a photographer and what the wilderness, what wilderness really means.
Graham Pohl is an award-winning author and photographer from the Kispiox Valley. His catalog of books include 13 published titles with over 300,000 books sold. Today I'm speaking with Graham Pohl about his photography exhibit opening up at the Misty Rivers Gallery in New Hazleton on November 1st. The show is a collection of captured moments from Graham's travels near and far, and it's called Between Worlds.
My name is Graham Pohl. I live in the Kispiox Valley north of Hazleton. Been here 25 years. Before that, I lived in the Southern Rockies, Yoho and Banff National Parks. And there I started a career writing guidebooks to the Rockies. Has since branched out into history, Rockies history, railway history, fur trade history, and a couple of novels. I worked as a paramedic for 32 years. So I had that as a sort of sideline to my writing work. And as part of my writing work, I packed a camera with me everywhere I went, starting in about 1981. Mm-hmm. So I've got about 40 years worth of photographs taken in the process of doing field work for books and research for books and just visiting lots of wild places in the mountains of Alberta and BC.
So I guess being a photographer then was more a necessity to document so that you had a picture for what you were writing about, or were they equally a passion for you, writing and photography?
Yeah, they were equal passions for sure. And yeah, the documenting things, the guidebooks get really detailed on trails about a particular species of wildlife you're likely to encounter or a particular plant or tree or whatever it is. And I would hike the trail, note those things, and often take photographs right there of that particular thing in that place that would then end up in the book. Where it describes that thing in that place. So there was a real integrity of the written topic and the visual thing.
What was your first or your earliest memory of being in awe of your landscape that you can think that you thought, I want to share this with people?
It didn't lead right away to the sharing, but the first time I came to the Rockies, I was living in Toronto at the time. I came out in 1982 for the summer. I was expecting to get into Banff at, I don't know, I think it was 10 in the morning. And the bus ran ahead of that. And I got into Banff at about 2 in the morning and got off in the dark. And it was raining lightly and it was clouds everywhere. I was looking around thinking, where are the mountains? And through that murk, I guess there was a bit of moonlight behind the clouds parted. And there was a mountain way higher up than I expected to see it. And that just struck me like that. There was some magic there, and I was drawn to a place that I hadn't yet experienced. But that first murky view of the mountains turned out to be significant for me. The sharing part came more from an interest in history. I was really interested in the mountaineering history of the Rockies, which goes back to roughly the mid-1880s, the first kind of European contact where the peaks started to get trundled. And I followed in the footsteps of a lot of those original accounts that were published in the 1890s and early 1900s and 1910s, and could see how the landscape had changed even since those descriptions were made a century earlier, 80, 90 years earlier. So it came from that. I had a few articles published that way. And then there's a road called the Icefields Parkway, which leads from Lake Louise to Jasper, 215 40 kilometers long. And I spent a lot of time doing trails and mountains off that road, and then thought, why not write a guidebook to the road itself? Because it offers so much for visitors. And I took that to a publisher, and the publisher said, this is great. I want you to do a book on the whole Rockies, just like this. So that's, I just walked into, it could have been anybody who walked through the door on a particular day, but it happened to be me. And that started my published writing career. So I was very fortunate that way. And then that I was really immersed in the Rockies for a better part of 15, 16 years. And then we moved to Northern BC here, Northwestern BC. And I transported that interest in mountain landscapes here. And of course, the history and the everything is different, very different. The geology, the botany, everything is different. Mm-hmm. So I was a bit of a fish out of water in terms of the knowing side of things, and still am. But the things I'd learned about traveling in the mountains and taking care of equipment and that kind of stuff in the mountains just obviously transported here. So I carried on a bit in that way here. Haven't done any books on this area and really don't plan to, but I still get out. We get out as a family and I take my camera and get images that way. Yeah.
Just briefly before we get into your exhibit, your photography exhibit, but you're a member of the Kispiox Valley Community Center Association. And correct, yeah. You were part of the association that spoke out and also made a declaration against the Prince Rupert Gas Transmission, or PRGT, pipeline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the declaration was not specific to that pipeline. It was for that kind of industrial presence, and that pipeline is now the fork that's poking us, representing that industrial presence, yeah.
Just giving a little context to your involvement and your care for this environment that you've been documenting and writing about. Is there an immediacy now to when you view this landscape and wanting to document this part of the world, and let's just call it BC, it doesn't even have to be specifically the Bulkley Valley or the Kispiox Valley, but do you feel there's an immediacy to document it now before you see industry? There's already industry here, but before you see more industry take over?
Yeah, and I have been doing that sometimes intentionally, and sometimes, you get to a certain place and you can see a sweep of the land that could be intruded upon by a pipeline. And so I take images of that. Yeah, there is an immediacy to capture some of these things and to also live in the knowledge of being alongside rivers that still have wild salmon and all the processes that are dependent on that side of the ecology. Because, with a disaster in the Skeena or the Kiss or the Bulkley watershed from pipeline construction, that could be lost. Irretrievably.
So, Graham, I would love to hear about the show. So I did get a sneak peek at some of the images that are going to be at your show. But yeah, please tell me and our listeners about your upcoming show.
Yeah, I'm calling it Between Worlds, and it's going to be a series of displayed canvas prints at the Misty Rivers Gallery in New Hazleton, BC. The show opens on November 1st and runs for the month of November. The opening night is going to be on Thursday, November 7th at 7 p.m. in the gallery. And as part of that, I'll be giving a short talk on some of the images and just a little bit about my view on what photography is, because photography in the 40 years that I've been doing it has changed from something being a geekish pastime to where now everybody is a photographer. The camera power that is available to anybody with a phone, let alone anybody with a camera, is phenomenal. The photos themselves are a real mishmash. Some come from the Rockies. I think the oldest one actually is 1988. And then there's a lot that sort of are fairly recent, within the last 3 or 4 years, of just out and abouts in the Hazleton, Smithers, Telqua area, some along the Skeena River. And it really struck me after the fact, after my wife Marnie and I chose the images to go on the program, how many birds there are in the images. That wasn't intentional, but there are a lot of powerful images of birds literally caught on the wings. And when you start to look for those kind of things and slow your eyes down, you'll start to see birds looking at you from the woods that you would have just walked past, for instance, or you just happen to move your head and catch one doing some stunt, like a raven doing a barrel roll or something. If your camera's in your hand, which is another part of my approach to photography, is, and I often lose at this one, is, my camera's still in the bag. It's not in my hand.
Yeah.
You might get the shot.
When I was looking through them, the one that caught me was, it's called Raven Descends.
Yeah.
And it just feels like one of those moments where it feels like you're framing a photo of this mountain, and a bird kind of photobombed you.
Yeah, so there's, and I'm going to show the sequence of photos in the opening night that led to that photograph. And most people will look at it and go, that's fake. So there's a trail in Old Hazleton on the riverbank. It's the bank that's built up to prevent flooding. And the power line, the phone line is fairly low down there when you're up on this levee. And we were walking along there going out to the point at Gitmax and at Cassant. And a couple of ravens were sitting on the phone line. And then I waited, and the one raven took off towards me. But the other raven did one of those little hops and then spread its wings and did this momentary glide. And I got a shot of it doing that, and then I got another shot of it lower down. But I cropped the photo to get this square with the raven looking like this giant thing falling out of the sky with the peak in the background. It's not a manipulation of the photo. It's just a crop and an enlargement. It really did happen.
I just wanted to finish up with, if you can choose one of your images in your upcoming show and maybe describe the image and the kind of the inspiration behind it.
So one of the images in the show is called Embers of the Day. And the peak that is center, most people call it Mount Tomlinson. And it is part of Mount Tomlinson, but it's the westernmost peak of a mountain that has something like 13 summits, and the true one is like way east and out of view in this photo. This particular photograph was taken about a 5-minute walk from my house, and in the wintertime, which is when the photo was taken, you can actually see the peak through the trees on our property, but there's a great view of it from the riverbank not far from our house. And so I often go to that riverbank at sunset, all times of the year, to see what happens. And this was one of those days. Mount Tomlinson's got a fresh plastering of late winter snow, and the sky behind it is really dark, except there's a couple of little puffy tufts of cumulus that are catching the light behind it. And then there's the alpenglow itself from the sun, which is filtered by the sun pass, the rays passing through different dust and moisture and whatever. And sometimes it'll be pink, sometimes it'll be orange, sometimes it'll be whatever. And this particular night, it was a soft golden yellow.
Yeah.
And it really looks like the mountain is glowing from within. And I've seen this same view. I've seen it like blood red. I've seen it orange. I've seen it pink. But this one just seems to have a life. And part of it's to do, I think, with the fact that the clouds in behind are catching a bit of light. If that was totally dark, you'd think, ooh, it's almost like it's too spooky or something. It was a bit unsettling. But it just seems this wave of the sunset is moving across the peaks and just lighting them up, and the clouds give it a little bit of animation almost. So I often go to that spot, and I'll be out there for an hour, and I've shot sunrises and moonrises especially. The moon comes up over these peaks at sunset, and you can get some spectacular arrangements of light and objects in the sky. So yeah, that's a favorite spot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Enjoyed taking that photograph.
It's really beautiful. And that's a really apt description that it looks like it's glowing from within.
Yeah.
So Graham, I just wonder, you don't have to have an answer to this, but for the people who are listening right now, what would be a challenge that you would like to give to get people excited about looking at the world with a different perspective?
Yeah, just touching back to the photograph we just described, one thing that is great to do is go to the same place at different times of the day or different times of the year or whatever. Just revisit places and see how they change with the seasons. And that will translate into you seeing other aspects of the landscape as almost like time lapse, like deeper on the temporal scale. Because the trap with snapshot photography, taking gazillions of things, is just, oh, that's my moment, and it's gone. And there is some value in having those moments, obviously, especially if you're sharing something special with a friend or whatever. But in terms of living in a place, and I guess honoring it is a way of saying it, having a longer term connection, and if photography is a way for you to do that, of revisiting the same place and taking images. And sometimes, like, I'll go to the riverbank that I just described, and the sunset will be an absolute dud. A bank of cloud will move in at the critical moment, and the moon's coming up, and cloud goes across it. And I've had that happen. It's like, oh, well, it's just like, you know, there'll be another day where it's like, I've actually sprinted from the house because I could see the colors starting to happen grab my tripod, sprint to that riverbank, and then, oh, I forgot, it's the full moon night, and there's the moon.